I am an alcoholic. My name is Jane. And for the newcomers, those who are feeling new, welcome. Welcome home. I hope this is where you find home, because I did. You know, by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 18th of September, 1996, which for this alcoholic is a miracle. I'm going to read a little something to you from the book, because that way I know you'll hear at least one truth in. Out on pages 151 and 152, it says, "Now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, 'I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time.' As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. We have shown how we got out from under. You say, 'Yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute?' Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you." That's true for me, and that is essentially my story. I walked into these rooms 19 and a half years ago. My little sobriety counter says it's 7,144 days, which I'm glad there's a calculator for it, because I don't want to keep track, because then I have to do arithmetic, and that's not so much fun. But when I walked into these rooms, I did not walk in here to get sober. I walked in here because I was in a world of hurt. My life had come apart. I was in continual emotional pain, and I was in the darkest spot I'd ever been in. I'm the fourth of five kids, so I have all those middle kid anxieties. I grew up, my teen years were in the 60s, so there's all that stuff that teenagers did in the 60s that we don't talk about here. And I never felt like I fit in. You know, I wasn't tall enough, I wasn't rich enough, I wasn't pretty enough, I wasn't thin enough, I wasn't smart enough. I just never was enough. And I went to my first year of college, and I did a lot of that stuff that we don't talk about, and I played a lot of bridge. And unfortunately, when you do that and you don't go to class, then the university says to you, please don't come back. So I ended up having to move to California because I figured my mom had given me a free room. And that was a mistake, because she said, if you're going to live with me, you're going to pay rent. So I had to get a job. So I got a job in the insurance industry. And this was the early 70s in Silicon Valley, and everybody in Silicon Valley worked in tech, unless you worked in the insurance industry. So I decided I didn't always want to do insurance, and I was really much better at science and math, and so I'd work during the day and go to school at night. Anyway, I ended up working in high tech. That was where my career path was. And I worked for a lot of startups. And startups are really wonderful things to work for if you're drunk. But I hadn't quite gotten to the point where I realized I was a drunk yet. Because I'd spent all that time saying, I'm not going to be like my dad. I'm not going to be like my brothers. So I'm not going to drink. And when I got to California, my mom's sister, who was a rocket scientist at Ames Research Center, a single lady, very bright, and we would go to dinner, and she would have a glass of wine or a martini, and she never got drunk. And I'd never seen anybody do that before. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. So when I turned 21, she said, well, let's go to dinner. And I said, that sounds great. And so we went to our favorite restaurant, and she ordered a split, which is, for those of you who don't know, that's a half a bottle of wine. It holds exactly 2 1/4 glasses if you pour it properly. So she had a glass, and I finished the bottle. Now, this should have told me something about my drinking patterns, and it didn't. And over the course of time, as we would go to dinner, because I thought, well, bad things didn't happen to me. The police didn't pick me up. I didn't black out. I didn't get drunk the way my brothers and my dad did. So we'd order a full bottle. And she'd have a glass, and I'd finish the bottle. Well, working at startup companies, wine is kind of slow to take effect, relatively speaking. And when I'd get home from work, because they were usually 12 to 14-hour days, my mind would be going like this. What new thing are we going to do tomorrow? What major breakthrough are we going to have? And so I discovered that vodka with some Rose's lime juice and some ice really did a much better job than a glass of wine in slowing my mind down. And so initially that started off as a single, and I drink that real fast and then sip a single the rest of the night. And then pretty soon it devolved into having a double and sipping a single. And then I realized that the Roses was taking up room, so I just did the vodka. And then shortly after that, I realized that the ice was a problem because it waters things down, so I'd put my stuff in the freezer. And so now I was doing doubles real quick and then sipping a double. And so that's the way my drinking progressed. It wasn't until I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard anybody say, and I knew I was really an alcoholic when I started drinking vodka, because that's all I ever drank. And it didn't dawn on me that my drinking was alcoholic. You know, startup companies are interesting. As I said, we work 12 to 14 hours a day. During crunch time, we'd work 7 to 21 days in a row. And crunch time always revolved around whether there was a funding cycle going on. Early in the funding cycle, the refrigerator at work was full of really good quality booze and great food. And at the end of the funding cycle, if you had beer and pretzels, you were lucky. So you were always working hard to get that next round of funding, partially because the refrigerator was better. But I'd go home at night, and I just could not turn off my brain. And so there I was, drinking like a fish, working like a crazy woman, doing exciting and new things that nobody had ever done before. And all of a sudden, one day, this redheaded guy walks across the laboratory floor from one end to the other, and I went, I want to have his kids. Now, my thought processes may have been just a little twisted at that time. I have this thing about redheads, but this one I decided that was going to be the father of my children. And so 6 months later, we got married, and his mother was not happy, and his family wasn't happy, and they were all very disappointed because he was a nice Catholic boy from Chicago, and the second son, and they had figured he would go into the priesthood. Now, the fact that he had left seminary and gone to engineering school and gotten a graduate degree in engineering had nothing to do with reality for them. I caused him to not become a priest. So I didn't fit in my married life either. And the truth is, he grew up in an alcoholic home just like I did. And so his distorted sense of the world and mine fit hand in glove together. So he could take something and turn it into the world's worst thing because his awfulizer worked full time. And I could take something and turn it into the world's worst thing because my awfulizer worked full time. And so we had, I guess the nicest thing you could say is we had a very volatile relationship. And in retrospect, you know, God works in funny ways. We ended up with a beautiful red-headed daughter, and that's the best thing that came out of that relationship. I can tell you what doesn't work in relationships based on that. Can't tell you what does work, but I can tell you what doesn't work. So there I was, working high-tech. Could not keep the house clean enough for a guy with OCD. And we have this beautiful red-headed baby who doesn't know what clean means because she's so young. And so, you know, I'd get home from work. I'd pick my daughter up from daycare, go home, and I'd sit her in her high chair, and the first thing I'd do is pour me a drink. And I'd do that because I just needed to take the edge off. You know, I just was restless, irritable, and discontented. And I needed to take the edge off because I knew I had to get dinner ready, but I had to get stuff cleaned up before I could get dinner ready, and I had to take care of this kid. And it wasn't working for me. So I needed a drink. And there sat my little red-headed girl, being ignored while I took that first drink in order to be able to function. And then her dad had come home, and dinner would be on the table, and I thought we were just having a swimmingly good time because, don't you know, I'm working, and I'm taking care of our daughter, and I'm putting a hot meal on the table every day, and I'm getting laundry done at least once a week, and things are good. Well, I'm drinking all the way through it, and my drinking's getting worse, not better. And somewhere around 4 years old, this little girl steps in between her father and I, and looks up at us and says, "Stop." Because we were fighting. We were yelling and screaming and pushing and shoving and doing all the things that people do when they're angry at each other. And it broke my heart. But I didn't get sober then. All I did was go, "Well, if he'd behave better." And I had all sorts of excuses, if he would just do this. And around this time, he started working more. And the more he worked, the more I drank. And the more I drank, the more he worked. Now I'm a smart person. You would almost think I would figure this out. Not even a clue. Had no idea. So finally, when my daughter was about 8 years old, she was suicidal. And she just didn't want to be around anymore. And so we took her to a child psychologist. And I figured that they were going to give me the bullet points of how we could fix him so my daughter's life could be better. Because, you know, I was pretty sure she was upset because she had no time with her dad and she saw us fighting all the time, and that was all his fault. And one Friday at noon, this psychologist called me in because we were going to get the bullet points, you know. And she said, "You know, your daughter shows all the signs of growing up in an alcoholic family." And I said, "Well, I don't see how. Nobody at our house drinks." Now, at this point in my drinking, I was drinking a half a gallon of vodka every day to day and a half. I was drinking all the time. But she could tell by my daughter's behavior and the things that she talked about and the things she drew and the worries and fears that an 8-year-old has. And she didn't want to be here anymore. She just wanted it all to stop. Well, we argued back and forth for about 45 minutes discussing the nature of denial and whether or not one's really an alcoholic and all sorts of intellectual curiosities. And I went home and I got a juice pitcher out and I poured every bit of alcohol in the house that I could find into the juice pitcher. And I put 4 or 5 ice cubes in it and I sat in my chair that I usually sat in when I drank. And I drank out of the juice pitcher, mumbling to myself about what a lousy psychologist this woman was because she had the nerve to call me an alcoholic. And I finished that pitcher of booze that night, and I went to bed. And that next morning, I woke up, and I still had that big, empty hole in my heart that had been trying to fill up for so long. And once again, I felt like I was not enough. And the alcohol hadn't worked for me this time. It hadn't taken away all that pain. It hadn't hidden all that stuff that I tended to think about because I'm oh so smart. And so Saturday morning, I said, well, I guess I better call AA. And the reason that I decided to do that was because my dad's uncle had been a member, very active, in Alcoholics Anonymous in Denver, where I'd grown up. And he had 40-plus years of sobriety when he passed away in the 80s. So I knew that AA worked, at least for some folks. And I wasn't so sure I was an alcoholic, but I knew I was in enough pain that maybe, just maybe, this is where I belonged. So I called Central Office, and there was a fellow by the name of New York John who answered the phone, and of course he does what everybody does that answers the phone in Santa Clara Valley. He says, Alcoholics Anonymous, how may I help you? And I said, I think I need to go to a meeting. And he said, well, there's one today at noon on Blackford Avenue. And I said, I don't want to go today. I didn't. And he said, well, there's one tomorrow at noon on Blackford Avenue. I said, I don't want to go tomorrow. You can see I was really motivated to be here. The willingness was just dripping off me. And he said, in his very special New York way, well, when do you want to go? I think there were a few extra words in there, and they were probably things that we're not supposed to say on the FCC radio or anything like that, but they had a harshness to them, and I'm so oblivious, I can't tell you why I picked the day that I did, but I said, I want to go on Tuesday. Now, why would you pick Tuesday? I mean, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I guess. Tuesday. And he said, well, at noon on Blackford Avenue. And so at noon on Tuesday at Blackford Avenue, I went to that meeting. And it was held at the continuation school in the gymnasium. It was a huge meeting. And I should have had an indication because as I drove in, there were like 100 motorcycles all parked. But it was a continuation school, so I figured this was from the continuation school. And it wasn't. It was all the guys in the meeting. So this was a motorcycle meeting. And the lady speaking that day, and she won't mind if I use her full name because she always did when she was alive, was Bonnie Rock. And Bonnie Rock was a retired nun. But more importantly, she was a retired registered nurse. And the reason that's important is because she worked with my mom, who had been a registered nurse. And when Bonnie was at the height of her drinking, and I was just beginning, I partied with her. And I thought, this woman is a lush. I don't know how she does it. And I walked into this room, and there she is. And she shared her story that day. And I came away with a little bit of hope, because she looked me straight in the eye and said, you don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. I had a sponsor and a big book as I walked out of that meeting. And my sponsor said, are you willing to go to any lengths to get and stay sober? And because I was newly scrubbed and had all the wisdom of a newcomer, I said, you bet. And she said, well, call me at 9 a.m. in the morning. And I said, well, no, you don't understand. I have to be over at school to help with the clay bomb stuff, and I've got to be in the library, and I just don't have time to call you. And she looked at me and said, well, I guess you don't want to get sober, and turned around and walked off. And so I went running after her, because it shocked me that anybody would say that to me, because don't you know how important I am? And I said, you bitch. I have this way of endearingly talking to people. The years have kind of toned it down some, but not always. And she said, look, if you want to get sober, you'll call me at 9 in the morning. And that was it. That was the end of it. And oddly enough, in my really busy, super important schedule, I managed, because this was the days before cell phones, and so I managed to borrow one of the phones at school, and I gave her a call. And so she set up another meeting. And that started my journey down this set of steps that changed my life. You know, going to meetings was really interesting early on, because I heard all these slogans, and I heard people say stuff like, put the plug in the jug. Just keep coming back. It'll get different. Nobody promised me that it would get terrific. Nobody promised me that there would be Skittles and unicorns and sunshine and happy days and anything. What they promised me is that my life would change. And because I was so desperate, and because my life was so dark, that was good enough. Because if this didn't work for me, I had Plan B in my back pocket, and that didn't have a happy outcome. So I started this journey, and it's interesting to me, the book talks and people talk about all you need is a little bit of willingness, all you need is a little bit of honesty, all you need is a little bit of open-mindedness. I had zero willingness when I came in here. I fought my sponsor every step of the way. You know, at our first meeting, she said, I just want you to understand, I'm going to take you through the steps. We're going to study the book. I'm not your banker. I'm not your social worker. I'm not your friend. I said, good, I'm not looking for friends. She said, good, because I'm not going to be it. And she'd say, go home and do this writing. And I'd go, I don't understand why that works. And she'd go, uh-huh, go home and do the writing. And I'd go, but I don't understand why that works. And she said, you know, oddly enough, when we open the book to this chapter, it's not why it works, it's how it works. So we're doing how. I fought her every step of the way, because it intellectually did not make sense to me how this stuff could change my life, let alone how it could make it possible for me to be happy about my sobriety, whatever that was. And so she fought me every step of the way, because I kept wanting to know why, and she just kept saying how. And I'd go, but why? And she'd go, how? And we spent a lot of time doing that. And I'd sit in these meetings and they'd say, you know, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I'd go, well, that doesn't sound right. And they'd go, Well, any idiot can stay sober for 24 hours, and they'd look at me. And then they had all these crazy sayings like you do on the back wall here. Think, think, think. Well, that's all I did. That's it. You know, that my whole life was spent thinking. I could think myself into a depression faster than most people. And my depressions have an awfulizer to it that end up in nuclear war with an entire devastation of everything and everyone but me. Which only turns out well if I'm stuck at the liquor store. That never happened. You know, so my thinking's a bit skewed. And it would say, there but for the grace of God. Well, I knew what my life was like. And I didn't feel like I had very much grace. And I didn't think God had been very fair to me. And then there were things like, easy does it? Don't you know how important my problems are? If you had my problems, you'd drink too. If you had my problems, you'd be angry too. Can't you see the injustice that I'm dealing with? That's exactly what you would do. No. And that's exactly, because that's what all that is. I would just spew. And why my sponsor put up with me, I have no clue. I don't. Because every time she'd give me something to do, I'd go, but I don't understand why this works. She'd just shake her head. You know, for the first 5 years of my sobriety, she called me Jane Wayne. And she'd do that because I thought it was a really good idea, since she wasn't my social worker or my banker or my friend, that if I got a bright idea, because I hadn't figured out, I still didn't believe the book when they told me my thinking was twisted and a bit off kilter. And so I'd run into a problem and I would decide that I could handle it and I would have a solution for it, because I'd done that all my life. And I'd call her up and go, hey, guess what I did today? And she'd go, oh, no. And then there'd be the times I'd call up and go, I've been thinking. And she'd go, oh. Because that usually meant that I'd done something as well as thinking. She said, well, we'll deal with the consequences. And we did. We spent a lot of time dealing with consequences. It took me a while to get to the point where I would call her up and go, you know, I've had this problem come up and I think this is what I should do about it. And she'd go, oh, well, that's one way of looking at it. And then eventually I'd call her up and I'd go, you know, I have this problem. And she'd go, really? Is it a problem? And then I'd finally call her up later on, closer to 5 years of sobriety, and I'd go, this is what's going on in my life. Can you give me some feedback? It took me a long time to utilize all of the resources that are in the room. You know, people in the rooms have gone through most of life's experiences. At 1 year sober, and I will tell you, my first 2.5 years of sobriety just sucked. You know, if I had thought that drinking was a solution at that point, I'd have just gone out and had as much to drink as I possibly could. At 1 year sober, I got handed divorce papers that started divorce proceedings that took 7.5 years to complete. And there wasn't a time of it that was anything other than angry and painful and miserable. At 9 months of sobriety, I got a return of a health condition that I thought had been taken care of 10 years before. And so I got a chance to go through surgery and chemo and radiation. And at 2.5 years of sobriety, as I stood before the judge in Santa Clara County, because they had a special pilot program on, and they said, well, you know, I know usually you wait and we ask the husband to move out and continue to pay child support, and everything's put in arrears till the minor child is of major age. But we're trying a new thing, and so whoever can afford to pay the mortgage gets to live there. Well, I've been a stay-at-home mom for 10 years, so I didn't get to live there. And I found myself homeless, though not really, because I got the minivan. So I had the minivan, and I got to, for almost six months, live out of that. Which sounds really crappy, and yet, oddly enough, it underscored something that my sponsor had me do within the first month or so of my sobriety. She had me write a gratitude list. Now, we all remember how willing I was, right? And how focused I was. And so I wrote a gratitude list that said, I'm grateful to have a roof over my head. I'm grateful to have hot and cold running water. I'm grateful to have a flushing toilet. I'm grateful to have all my fingers and toes. And I'm grateful to have toilet paper on a roll. And she said, that's fabulous. I love that list. Put all five of those on a little 3x5 card. Make a stack of five. Put one in your bathroom. Put one in your car. Carry one in your pocket. Have one by your bedside. So every time before you say the third step prayer in the morning, because she had me reading 60 to 63, finishing with the third step prayer every single day of my sobriety. And I was supposed to include this. And I did. And so at 2.5 years sober, when I had a roof over my head, and I knew where there was hot and cold running water, because I knew where all the 24-hour restaurants were, because we AAs like to go out and eat after meetings, don't we? Or before meetings, or sometime in between meetings. And they had, oddly enough, restrooms and flushing toilets and toilet paper on rolls. And I could usually park my car somewhere in one of those parking lots. And the police didn't bother me too much because it was an okay part of town. But I understood what that gratitude list was all about then, because it became very, very real to me. If I were to say to you that I was a shining example of spirituality and joy and sobriety, I would laugh. Because I whined and moaned and complained to my sponsor about how unfair it was that all this stuff was happening to me. And as I would wham, wham, wham about it and tell her how I deserved better, and she'd look at me and she'd just laugh. And then she'd go, you don't want what you deserve. And I'd, yes, I do. I want what I deserve. And she pointed it out to me by going back to the doctor's opinion and some of the stuff in the first 164 pages, that what I deserved, because I'm a drunk, is to either be in an institution, in jail, or dead. And that would kind of get my attention, and so we'd go on to happier things. You know, it was a challenge because my daughter did not understand why the courts kicked me out of the house. But I picked her up every day and took her to school, and picked her up from school and took her home until she was 15. And then she was sick and tired of my smothering, because I had decided not only was I going to be a great AA, I was going to be a perfect mother and make up for all that time that I had screwed up her life. And if you could define the word smother and put my picture right there, I spent my time smothering. And she looked at me one afternoon when I had gone just one step too far, and she said, "Get out of my life. I don't ever want to see you again, and I will not talk to you anymore. Don't pick me up for school tomorrow." Well, I have to admit, that was an arrow through the heart, and it pretty darn near broke me. And the first thing I did is I went to a meeting, and there were some of my women friends there with long-term sobriety who'd raised children and had gone through the teenage years with them. And they told me, "Don't drink. Keep coming back. It'll change." And I went, "But you don't understand. I know my daughter. She's as stubborn as I am. She's never going to talk to me again." And he said, "Yeah, that could be true." And I went, "But how do you deal with that?" And they said, "Hurts, doesn't it?" And I went, "Yes." And they said, "Well, we can't fix that. We don't fix normal." Well, that's not the one answer I wanted. I wanted them to show me some way to make this okay. And there was no way to make it okay. I'd overstepped my boundaries because I hadn't learned to set decent boundaries. I was parenting out of guilt, and I smothered this kid to the point where she wanted nothing to do with me. I had to own that, which meant all those things in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 became really vivid for me. I was not in right relation with all my fellows. I was not doing what was asked of me to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. I was not being a good AA. So that little girl, though she was a young lady at the time, graduated high school and came off to Georgia to go to college. She originally went to Savannah College of Art and Design because she wanted to be a sequential artist. For those of you who don't know what that means, she wanted to do comic books, anime. And she's a terrifically good artist. But 3 weeks in, her English professor called her in and said, "Why are you here? You're too smart to be here." And then that same day in her art class, they handed out 12-inch wooden rulers and said, "We're going to spend the next 3 weeks learning how to use these." Well, this is a young lady who knew how to use architectural scales. So she called on the phone and said, "I'm switching schools. I'm going to become a nurse, and I'm going to go to North Georgia College and State University." I went, "Okay." So she did that. And she graduated with her associate's degree first. And the day she did that, she got married to the Georgia boy she met and fell in love with. And I was still working in high tech and doing crazy stuff. And so she was finishing off her bachelor's while she worked and maintained a household. And then I was working at the National Ignition Facility, which is this really high-tech stuff, and we were going to do fusion and give you cheap energy and all that stuff. And it wasn't going well, but they went through a round of layoffs because they were spending too much money, which most of the companies I worked for either bellied up or went through layoffs about every 2 years. And so at that round of layoffs, by now my daughter was talking to me. I thought we had a pretty good relationship, though it was long distance. And the ladies had been right. You know, I just kept coming back. I didn't take a drink. I allowed myself to own what I had done. And we were starting to heal. And so when she found out I was out of work, she said, "Mom, you're close enough to retirement. Why don't you just come out to Georgia and be closer to family?" Well, I didn't think I'd ever get that invite. In fact, I was shocked. And I looked around at the employment situation where I was, and I went, it sounds like a good idea. So in May of 2013, so 3 years ago, I drove out here to Georgia to make this my home. But I had decided my leave date somewhere back in January or February. And the folks in Santa Clara County, because I got sober in Santa Clara County, California. And the folks in Santa Clara County did things like they'd come up to me and go, you know, you didn't bring this before the group conscience. I'm not sure we're going to allow you to leave. I'd look at them. And I said, yeah, but my daughter wants me to come out, and that's good enough. You know, 70 of those folks showed up for dinner in July of 2015 down in Atlanta at the International to have dinner with me. When I was drinking, I don't think I could have found 7 people who would have been willing to have dinner with me. They didn't come out to the International to see me. They go to the International every chance they get, which is once every 5 years. But they made a point of letting me know they were coming and arranging a dinner so we could all just have happy times again. That's pretty special. And that's pretty unique. And that happens in the rooms of AA if you give yourself a chance to become part of. You know, I got a chance to be part of a discussion panel at the International in Atlanta. And what an honor that was to speak before 800 people. Not quite as big as the big room in the Georgia Dome, but pretty close to the, not quite, but pretty close to the largest crowd I've ever spoken before. And it's humbling because all I have done, willing or otherwise, is to just show up and to do what's recommended. And the darn thing is, my life has gotten better. You know, I've had the ups and downs and the bumps and the spots, and I've had those moments where sometimes it just didn't seem worthwhile. And what I've found is that I don't have to drink again even when I want to. Because you guys gave me tools that allow me to address the fact that I have this mind that's kind of off-center and twisted, and if that idea of a drink comes through my mind, I don't have to obsess about it anymore. The obsession is gone. And as long as that's true, I'm in pretty okay shape. Because until I take the drink, the craving won't start. So if I can deal with the obsession, then I'm doing pretty okay. And that's what it is to be recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Because that's certainly where I was when I walked in. You know, that little red-headed girl who became a nurse, and that would have made my mom so proud. That little red-headed girl who became a nurse worked at an Alzheimer's and hospice facility when she first got out of nursing school. And there was a woman one night who had a code, and it was the first time my daughter had ever had to call a code. And she called me on the phone because I was still in California. And it must have been about 2 or 3 o'clock here. And all I could hear at first was her suck in a great big breath of air. And then she just started weeping. And I sat on the phone for about 5 or 10 minutes as she just wept. And then finally could catch her breath enough to tell me that she'd had to call her first code. And she described to me some things that you folks don't want to hear about, but that just broke her heart. You folks, and people in rooms like this, taught me how to be still so that I could hear that without trying to fix it, so that I could be okay with her just pouring out her heart to me. And what a gift that was. But sometimes she'd call with stories that were a little more cheery. There was one lady who, as my daughter was trying to get meds together to deliver them, she could hear her at the end of the hall saying, "Oh God, I've gone blind. Is anybody there?" And so my daughter went chugging down to the end of the room and looked in. "I've gone blind. Isn't anybody there? Oh God, please help me. I've gone blind." And my daughter says, "Open your eyes, Mrs. A." Alzheimer's unit. Folks don't always know. And again the woman calls out, "Oh God, please help me. Isn't anybody there? I've gone blind." And so my daughter walked into the room and stroked the woman, said to her, "I'm going to stroke your cheek," and did so. And Mrs. A opened her eyes and grabbed my daughter's hand and said, "Oh, thank God, you know, I was blind and couldn't see." I loved that story for oh so many reasons, not the least of which was I was so proud of her, of my daughter, to be able to give that kind of care and that kind of concern and that kind of gentleness to a person in a condition where it would be easy to ignore. And this is what I wish for all folks in the hospital. But that story just rolled around the back of my head for several weeks. And it kind of nibbled at the back of my memory. And I couldn't figure out why until one night at a meeting when I was called on to share. And all of a sudden it dawned on me. That's so much like what my life in AA is. You know, there are times I am blind and I cannot see. And you folks touch me and my eyes open. And I consider those moments of grace. And in that grace, I always tend to think of the hymn that at least was very prominent in the church I grew up in. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost and now am found, was blind and now I see. Thank you all for being here tonight. I can't stay sober without you."